hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for the modern hoarder. I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me as usual it's Sean Patton and the Ashford to my Simpson. Hello Sean, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Andrew Harrison.
Splendid, okay. Thank you for ruining my weekend with the Dear Joan and Jerrica podcast, which meant I couldn't get anything else done.
Yes, I did recommend it to you.
Yes, this is, please yes. Explain to the listeners what it is if they don't know it.
Dear Joan and Dear Jerrica is a podcast by Vicky Pepperdine and Julia Davis, which they have produced and put out themselves entirely, and it features two agony aunts, presumably from somewhere in Middle England, who answer readers' queries.
In a horrible and graphic manner.
And yes, I was going to say, it's very, very graphic. It's very filthy. It's very rude. They are both deep misogynists,
yes.
Which makes it even funnier because a lot of women write in with the problems and they usually blame the woman and praise which errant husband it is. I can't do it justice. It is the funniest thing. I've sat on public transport embarrassed because I am killing myself.
Weeping with laughter.
With laughter, yes, because it's absolutely disgusting as well. It makes Sally Forever look clean, discussed last week.
It's like the Daily Mail female magazine in the form of a podcast. We have two special guests with us this week to help us rummage through the TK Maxx of rock and roll. Richard Benson is a former editor of The Face magazine and the author of books including The Farm, The Story of One Family and the English Countryside, and The Valley, 100 Years in the Life of a Family. He now writes for Hole and Corner as well as Wired and Esquire magazines, which are possibly going to merge into Esquired soon with AI cufflinks and intelligent ties. Hello, Richard. Welcome back to Big Mouth. How are you doing?
Hello, Andrew. I'm very well, thank you.
Have you noticed the giant wall of Face magazine covers down at King's Cross?
I have seen the giant wall of Face covers on Instagram and social media, and people have sort of sent me them and said, do you know why this is there? And I don't really know why it's there, so it's quite strange.
You want to pop down and be like seeing your life flash before you in a kind of gigantic, literally in the form of a wall.
Yes. Imagine your life flashing before you in the form of a wall. Listening to Pink Floyd. Yes, I will go and have a look. I think when you're involved in stuff like that, the memories aren't always that great. I mean, you must have a similar thing. So you look at covers that, even ones that people remember fondly, you think, well, you know, what I remember about that is the point when actually it wasn't going to happen and we had to put the printing back. So, you know, or maybe that was just me, I don't know. But yeah, I will go and have a look at
it. But it is remarkable the way the Face has kind of retained this kind of cultural touchstone thing in the way lots of other mags haven't. I mean, the Face is kind of, it's now a set text for Central St. Martin's design type kids.
It does seem to be like that, doesn't it? Yeah, which is quite a sobering thought when you think about what the stuff that you write, you wrote at the time. But it's nice to see it, and it's good. It's I mean, I do think, you know, outside of my involvement in it, I mean, as an editor on something like that, you just get to publish writing that you think is great, and it gives me genuine pleasure and joy to think of some of the pieces that we published having still continuing to live. I mean, I always love the our mutual friend sort of Gavin Hills is writing, and the thought that 20-year-olds might still get exposed to that makes me feel, you know, warm inside, you know. Yeah. So that's great.
Now, you're from near Wetwang in Yorkshire.
I'm from Wetwang in Yorkshire.
You're from literally from Wetwang.
I grew up most of my life in Wetwang, yeah.
Have you been to see the Wetwang Slack art exhibition by Francis Uprichard at the Barbican?
I've heard about this, but no, I have not been to see it. I'm very familiar with Wetwang Slack.
Wetwang Slack, tell the listeners what it is, because they'll be baffled.
Wetwang Slack is, in that area, a slack is a name for a valley. And Wetwang Slack was the site of a quarry where, in the late 60s, one of the most important archaeological finds about the Iron Age ever in the history of archaeology took place. Mm. And my brother used to know the quarryman who found the stuff, weirdly enough.
There's a book in that. Who knows the quarryman?
Do you know, I said to him, I said, well, what? So do you know what happened when they found it? Because they said, you know, they literally dug a digger into a chalk sort of cliff face and pulled away a chariot. I said, what an amazing thing to have found. And he said, yeah, he just went to the boss and said, there better be some money in this for me, or otherwise I'm filling it back in. Good old Yorkshire.
So we start out with 70s Doctor Who and we end up with Steptoe and Son there.
Yeah.
So this exhibition, it takes the name of Wetwang Slack. It's actually, it's very Face, actually, isn't it, Sean? Because you've been. And
yes, I loved it. I thought it was really good. It is as if all these things have been unearthed or they're about to go in. You're not quite sure. You know, the end of civilization at some point, isn't
multicoloured grotesqueries of from various parts of from consumerism and interior design and pottery and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and hats. A lot of very funny hats. But also, I was looking at the method, and it's from this resin that you can get in Brazil, and she's one of the few people that actually can handle it. You have to put, you have to heat it up very, very hot, 80 degrees. Then you put an enormous cold bath. So the bath must have been enormous, and she's sort of trying to weld it, and there are these beautiful things that look like Iron Age mythic gods on strange four-legged creatures. And I'm just imagining her grappling with that and wet water and also then wet wangs. Yeah, it's good. Go and see it.
We never do ours on this show, do we? We should do more ours.
Oh, yes.
Wet Wang is, of course, the best Yorkshire place name of all, although I did see Booze and Wham. And there's also a great fry-up Dale and a jingling pot. Any other favourites, Richard?
Well, there's a place quite near where we live called Thwing, which I always...
Thwing!
Yeah, which sounds like you've got a lisp, doesn't it? But it's actually called Thwing.
It sounds like something that Bill and Ted would say with a lisp.
Yes, Thwing. It does, yeah. And there's also, famously, Blubberhouses is in West Yorkshire. And so there's plenty of them. The weird thing is if you grow up there, I genuinely do not hear what's funny about the name. So you just go, where do people...
Well, a town called Booze or Crackpot is not funny.
Well, Wet Wang isn't funny to me because it was just the name of, you know, the school and where I went. So, you know, it empties out. So every time I see it cited as a funny place, I think it's not funny to me.
Really. Well, it's a War of the Roses edition of Big Mouth this week, yes, because our other guest is from Ormskirk in West Lancashire. Anthony Teasdale has reinvented himself as a metropolitan toff. He edits the Gentleman's Star magazine Umbrella, Ella, can I say that? As well as creating content for luxury brands across the internet. Mm. Can I get into that, please? He's actually a rusticated scouser. He's the king of casual style and looks like he's just stepped off a yacht in Ibiza in 1965. And you're big on the Balearic scene, apparently. Anthony, how are you?
I won't say big. I'm sort of like medium sized.
Medium, that's not bad.
Vaguely.
You know, I mean, if even that, really. I remember when I used to buy goalkeeping gloves, they came in a size called youths. And I think I'm youth size in Balearic. Yeah, I'm absolutely fine. I've had a pretentious coffee this morning. Which makes me feel slightly sort of scatty and sort of a bit on edge. But everything else in my life is fine. I'm very much enjoying the talk about Yorkshire places.
There we go. Well,
does Lancashire beat Yorkshire with place names? Right, we've got Pimbo, Slyne and Knob End.
Pimbo is an industrial estate in Skelmersdale.
Right.
So where me and Andrew are from, obviously we've said this before, me and Andrew are from the same Liverpool 39 postcode. There's lots of K's where we live, so there's Kirby near me, Skelmersdale, Ormskirk. There's quite a Viking feel.
There's
a lot of Vikings, and it's this Viking flat, desolate place. Mm. I mean, Yorkshire is sort of interesting, and we're sort of like, I don't know, I think we're like the High Barnet of the Northwest. Using the old county boundaries of Lancashire, I'd say the thing about Lancashire is Yorkshire can provide a unified voice of Yorkshire. Whereas Lancashire is full of places like Liverpool and Manchester, and everyone hates each other.
Mm. Yes.
And that is a big difference. There's, you know, it's we have our own inter-regional hatred that sort of trump any sort.
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. So,
is this ever reflected in Umbrella?
Umbrella. Well, I mean, with Umbrella at the moment, we tend to, in Umbrella, one of my most favourite articles was one we did on trendy pensioners of the world.
Nice.
I'm going to be one of them, I hope.
So, I mean, if you want trendy pensioners, if you're looking for knitwear,
where to
Spain.
Go? Spain.
Spain,
okay.
If you're looking
and
for...
knitwear?
It's a cold morning in Seville.
Right.
Wow.
It's December.
It's another book.
There's a lovely knitwear. There's a lovely lamb's wool jumper going on. That's where you want to be with the pensioners of Seville.
Fantastic. I see. You got right back into your Balearic mixing. You've played Spiritland recently.
Yes, I have. That's a great place. Now, if you don't live in London's fashionable London, I would suggest that when you aren't getting back on the train to either Euston or King's Cross, you pop in. It's fantastic. It's got a great sound system. It sells lager. And you can hear morons like me playing self-indulgent records.
Is Balearic House the mellow jazz for today's mature gentleman, then?
Yes, I think it is. Balearic encompasses anything that's a bit poppy, a bit Mediterranean, a bit weird, but a bit catchy. It's not pretentious. And whereas, you know, older people would say, well, I can't listen to that because it's by that artist, we revel in the fact that Cliff Richard has made an excellent Balearic record.
Mm. What is the Cliff Richard Balearic record?
Tell us more.
Is it wired for sound at 33 RPM?
I mean, there is there is. I'm going to have to get back to you on that. There is one.
Figuratively, yes.
But no, there is one, and I will come back to you and look it up.
Excellent.
There.
Okay.
Wonderful. Andrew, what's on the show this week?
Well, we'll be ruining the mellow mood with the new album by Incorrigible Rage, Rave Old Stages, The Prodigy, which rejoices in the title No Tourists. What will we unreconstructed ravers make of it, and how do The Prodigy remain so successful without ever changing in the slightest? Plus, it's a pop music light week this week, as we have two television programmes to talk about. Sabrina the Teenage Witch was a cult hit in the 90s, ostensibly aimed at teenagers. It contained enough corny vaudeville jokes to appeal to older viewers in the dying days of Saturday morning TV. But does the Netflix reboot The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina? Yes, inevitably it's darker. Hit the spot. And is Kiernan Shipka from Mad Men anywhere near a Melissa Joan Hart? And we're going to be looking at Channel 4's new espionage series Berlin Station, featuring Reese Ifans and, with David Bowie's I'm Afraid of Americans as its theme tune, as well as the traditional selection of tunes from our guests. All this and more after a reminder from Sian.
Don't forget, you can get a little bit more Big Mouth in your inbox, which sounds really rude, every week, and help us to cover our costs if you back us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. The luxury subterranean panic room where we record the show doesn't come cheap. It's not that expensive either, but it does cost some money, so we're asking for your help. If you can spare the equivalent of the price of a pint per month, which, let's face it, is about £5 now in the sort of places you lovely Big Mouth listeners frequent, we will send you the extra bit, as we call it, every week, just after Big Mouth comes out. This week, for no good reason at all, we're going to ask, what are the worst album titles of all time? Because there are some. Search Patreon Big Mouth or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more. All we're saying is, buy us a pint.
Okay, The Prodigy. Back in 1992, they burst onto a rather uptight dance music scene with an absolute racket of breakbeats, raw noise and chipmunk-style samples. And 26 years and 7 albums later, they're back with an absolute racket of breakbeats, raw noise and chipmunk-style samples. Oh, The Prodigy, the AC/DC of rave music, a primal noise that need never change and should never change because they got it right first time. Do we ever grow out of a horrible racket? And what must it be like to be Keith Flint when you're knocking on the door of 50? We will discuss these matters and more after a track from the new album. This is We Live Live Forever. We Live Forever by The Prodigy from the new album No Tourists, and it really couldn't be anybody else. Richard Benson, you put The Prodigy on the front of the face when Firestarter was about to be a hit. Can you remember what made them stand out to you at the time?
Oh, I mean, for the face, it was the visual of Keith Flint. And the problem with rave music, and as you will know, it was this, you know, obviously very popular and very important, but there was never rarely was there a strong visual.
There's only so many gurning bald men you can put in front of the camera, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. And they, you know, in Technics T-shirts, they just always used to have short hair and Technics T-shirts, didn't they? You just think, oh, yeah, another one. And so then when the Prodigy fronted up like a group, didn't they? Even though, I mean, it's really Liam, isn't it, with the sort of blokes, but because you'd got a kind of a not only a strong visual, but also somebody whose movement and look, you know, gave a sort of a manifestation to the feel of that music. I mean, he Keith Flint in that video looks like what being off your nut in a field at 2 a.m. feels like.
Yes.
That was the brilliant thing about him. So it was great. The problem we had with that cover, which has always slightly clouded my feelings about the Prodigy, is that we were supposed to put the whole band on. Mm. And I never intended to put the whole band on, so I said, oh, make sure you get some shots of Keith on his own. And I knew that they'd be annoyed and I did that bad thing. But when a guy from the record company, I won't mention names, but the guy from the record company rang up after it came out and asked me to write a letter saying that it would be my decision. And in all honesty, I've never heard a man so frightened.
Yeah.
And I said, well, tell him to contact me and I'll take the blame for it. He said, oh, no, we can't do that. But there was kind of real fear. So I was like, oh, you know, that kind of, the darkness is real, you know.
I remember the cover line was psychosomatic addict insane. It's the Prodigy. That's all you needed to say.
That summed it up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the music press in general, broader music press, were a bit sniffy about them when they arrived. It's like, who were these Essex louts? What about proper techno made by bald men in Technics T-shirts? And yet they absolutely smashed it and they never looked back. Do you still like them? Did you like them at the time?
Oh, yeah, because that... Music for the Jilted Generation was a great album, and it still is a great album. I listened to it again, listened to this, because I was thinking, God, where... this album, it just feels like, you know, it's more of the same. It's what you expect. Yeah. I thought, God, were they better or what? And I went back and listened to that, and I listened to Firestarter again. And I think they were putting more effort in then. If you listen to just the layering in the music, it's just more thought through and it's more interesting. So I thought they were great, and there was a kind of an idea to them. And now it's just quite solipsistic, and it just goes on doing the same thing now. But I think they were a properly important good band.
Did you enjoy this one just in its own right, rather than how it fits into the Prodigy continuity of the canon?
There was some. I mean, the problem with like an album like that for me is it's like, you know, it's not meant to be listened to in your kitchen. It's meant like they makes the. I find it hard to listen to more than about three tracks at a go. But it's not meant to be listened to there. It's meant to be part of the live experience of them for me. I mean, they always came out with that rave culture, and
or probably in your tricked out, your car that you spent all your minimum wage money on to put the sound system in to rattle the windows.
Well, you see, it's funny because I thought the car analogy, because I was thinking, what's the analogy to this? And I thought it's like complaining that a kind of a modded, souped up Vauxhall Astra isn't, you know, an SUV. But it's not made for that. That car is made for burning rubber in a supermarket car park and showing off. That's what it's for, and it's brilliant at doing that. And that music is for that big live experience in a field, and as part of that, it would be amazing. But it's probably not. It's not probably made for listening to in the way that I was listening to it.
Superstore car park. Here we go. Anthony Teasdale, what did you make of it?
I was a bit disappointed because I thought it was much more rock than rave, so I was going to be hoping it was going back to their best LP, The Prodigy Experience.
Oh, here we go. The first one was the best one.
I mean...
I like the one that didn't come out, yes.
Yeah, I mean, going back to their earlier work here, I tend to find that there's a real serious statement being made by Charlie. I think so... On the plus side, I thought the beat side of it was fantastic. I think Liam Hallett is an incredible producer. And when Firestarter came out, I think when you said it was laid, it was incredibly complex, really snappy, fantastic danceable rave beat. I didn't like the other stuff as much, which was the more rock angle. And to me, this felt like a rock. This feels like a rock album rather than a dance album. That's up to them, but it's not quite for me. Yeah.
To be fair, though, there is masses of acid on this. There's loads of bibbly, bibbly, bibbly. Which is my Pavlovian instant response to that noise. I was like, oh, yeah, anything with that on it, I love it.
It's all at that sort of, without sounding as though I work for a hi-fi magazine, it's all about the different frequencies, which it's very much in the middle. It's very much, whereas I like music with lots of separation.
You like some with, and some,
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's all very much in that, and if you like that, then, so if you're a rock fan, I think you'll like that. If you're a dance fan like me, I don't think you will as much.
The funny thing is, I'm not a rock fan. I dance to disco because I don't like rock, but I love the Prodigy. They are my heavy metal. They are my headbanging music. And, you know, I've got all the records, and they pop up all the time at random on the phone, and I'm always happy to hear it. The surprise to me was, and that's what I was banging on earlier about, are they the AC/DC of techno? Because something popped up from Fat of the Land, and then four songs later something popped up from this, and I thought they sound like they were recorded at exactly the same time, which could have been 1997 or could have been last week. And when it's AC/DC, we applaud them. We say, fantastic, you've discovered a primal truth about rock and roll here. And when it's a Prodigy, people go, well, you're going to make a different record. What did you think, Sean?
I'm not sure, she said, uninterestingly. What I do think, I mean, I think Anthony's right in that they're resampling themselves quite a lot. I think they're sort of eating themselves in a postmodern way. And as you say, we deployed that in something more pop. But with dance, we're expecting that next step forward. We're expecting a new synthesizer sound or suddenly something different. I don't think the layering's there either. I was listening to it quite closely. And it's just flat. There seems to be, at some point, my glasses fell there.
Liam would take that noise and he would make it into a record.
Well, I hope he would. Is that I thought, you're really, really having a go, but I think you're stuck. And actually, underneath, I think they're really stuck. Mm. And they've made the record. It's taken a while. And I read some interviews about the process of doing it. They did it away a lot when they're on tour to kind of keep it fresh. But somehow, I think it still feels like three people really trying to find their feet still. And I'm getting a sense of unease underneath it that they're not quite sure either. I think it will do the rounds and they will play the festivals and it will be extraordinarily successful with the people who like that. But ultimately, is that an aim? Is that art?
I don't know. I mean, you know, you're playing in front of 50,000 people a night across Europe. It's got to be hard work, hasn't it? You've got to be happy, you know.
I'd love to hear Liam Howlett produce other people. I'd like to hear him produce hip-hop. I'd also like him to go and do a dance LP because I think...
You want some house from him?
Yeah, I want some house. I would like to hear how he would rework stuff that he did in 1991 and I'd just like to hear him do... Because he is one of the best maker of beats. He's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. And I'd like to hear that in a different vibe that isn't so rocky.
Well, to me, Richard was saying that the thing that made him stand out for the face was the look and the visuals. I remember sort of when I was doing Select in the early 90s, the thing that stood out was... Because I loved crappy rave made on crappy samplers. Mm. Is what I, you know, bought loads of 12 inches, played these terrible records at home. And then this thing turns up and the proposition is, what would this be like if it was really, really well produced by somebody who really understands musical structure? Yeah. And it was a revelation. It was like, it's like you've taken this basic template, which is brilliant and exciting in its own right, but what if it expanded into this enormous thing? And I remember being really floored by it. I think that's why there was an infamous cover of Mixmag where they had a picture of Liam holding a gun to his head saying, yeah, how did the prodigy Charlie kill rave? Rave. Yeah, and yeah. I think it's they were genuinely confused by it because it was, in one respect, it was coming from the oik end of dance music. It wasn't Derek yes. May. And at the other, and but it was also massively popular and undeniably brilliant pop music.
Yeah, I think they have a problem with pop music. They just keep not wanting to stray there, and so it's holding them back. They're not the Norman Cooks, are they? They still want to be a bit punk, and I find that is maybe where I'm finding a little bit stiff and kind
I like
of
it because it appeals to my inner 12-year-old, basically.
What I would say to listeners, go and listen to Your Love by The Prodigy, which is a fantastic piano house record.
Yeah, with very plinky-plinky pianos on it.
Yeah, and it's brilliant, still brilliant.
What must it be like to be Keith now? Because Keith's like kind of our age and he's covered in tattoos and he's still got the kind of Mr. Toad meets Johnny Rotten meets Grimly Fiendish thing on the go. I don't know.
I think so. And I noticed on the Prodigy website you can buy Firestarter t-shirt still. So there's that kind of like commodification of him as well, yeah, which is weird now. I guess they must be... Is it a bit like what it was like to be John Lydon or someone like that? You know,
possibly.
So yes. You've always had that problem with John Lydon. He's never quite known where to go, has he? I think that point you made about AC/DC and them, and then when Sean was talking about rock and pop, what's difficult is where's the kind of tradition? Because with rock, you can do the same thing over again because it's all about the blues and there's a classic. Well, yeah. I'm not saying I like that, but there's a kind of a way forward for you doing the same thing because it's rooted in a classic tradition. Whereas the problem with techno was it was always about making it new and about anticipating the future, wasn't it? So this kind of thing about where they fit in that.
When AC/DC kicked off, the tradition of hard rock was only about 5 years old. And it went back to a blues tradition that was older, okay, but it was maybe 40 or 50 years of history. The Prodigy now, this stuff has been around for 30 years. Mm. There are people going to see this stuff and freaking out under the metal spider at Glastonbury to this kind of thing. You weren't even born when The Fat of the Land came out, let alone when Charlie came out. So I actually, maybe there is a tradition then, and they made it. They were allowed to do it because they made it.
Which would then put them in a kind of a weird position, isn't it? Because then, do they keep doing the same thing because they're creating that tradition, or is that a problem? I think that's why it's quite hard to know where to put the album in your head, isn't it, when you're trying to
If you want to date the history of rock and roll from 1956, the Prodigy have been around for 45% of the history of rock and roll. That's a fair old chunk, isn't it? Yeah, let's face it.
We're old.
I give up.
Right.
Can I just say I'm a bit younger than everyone else?
Yes. Not that much younger.
Oh, no. Right, that's enough of that. Let's have a change of music. We always ask our guests to choose a tune for the show in the manner of the editor's recommendation from the Britannia Music Club. If you don't like it, send it back. Nobody ever did
no,
they?
No, they didn't.
Did anybody? Richard Benson, what have you chosen for the listeners?
I have chosen a remix of Everything She Wants by Wham. The remix is by a bloke who goes by the name of The Reflex. I don't know if people know The Reflex, but he's a French guy living in London called Nicolas Logier. And he does... He's a very subtle school of remixing. He only uses what he's given in the original tapes. It isn't like, you know, the Weatherall school of chucking in you know, all your own stuff. And so you kind of get this sense of sort of very finely tuned music that he'll just kind of tune it up for modern sort of dance floor, really. Did the most famous one he's done, I think I'm right in saying, is Lionel Richie's All Night Long. It was famously the last record played on Terrace at Space when that closed down. And I I liked his reworkings of old pop songs as well. Then the Everything She Wants by Wham.
This is a new remix of
Everything She Wants by Wham, which was the double A side with Last Christmas in 1984.
Oh. And you can actually get it on the internet. I think you can get it from Bandcamp or something. If you search for The Reflex and ESW, because he's keeping it secrety. The Reflex bootleg or re-edit or whatever it is, or anagram of Everything She Wants by Wham, as chosen by Richard Benson, which you can buy on certain legal sites, and we feel sure that dear departed Yogg would approve of that. Now, TV, specifically Netflix. No doubt mindful of the success of Stranger Things, the streaming TV giant is pumping out knowing ironic horror by the yard, and their latest release is a reboot of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, the Archie Comics character who became a miles better TV show than anybody would have expected in the 1990s. Does The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina hit the spot, as it were? Let's have a taster.
In the town of Greendale, where it always feels like Halloween, there lived a girl who was half witch, half mortal, who, on her 16th birthday, would have to choose between two worlds, the witch world of her family and the human world of her friends. And that girl is me.
Are you willing to forsake the path of light and follow the path of night?
It's very tempting to run. It's very tempting.
I can't do this.
You must.
I shall deliver Sabrina.
You're going to die, half-breed.
Girls, girls, let's not be catty bitches, hmm?
It's just that you've grown up before my very eyes.
You're a rebel, Spellman. It's how I like my witches.
We've got 99 Problems and a Witch Ain't One, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina on Netflix there. Now, this is definitely a YA proposition, and the collective age in this room, as we've established, is about 200 years old. Did any of us watch the original? Did anybody watch the original? I'm getting blank faces here.
I was out.
On Saturday morning. The original Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Yeah. Remember this in the 90s?
Yeah, but there was a version before that, was there not, in the early 70s?
Was there?
I think so.
Deep cuts.
I think in maybe 1969 or 1970, I think there was an American version of it. It might have been a cartoon. I don't know if that
was that. Are you thinking Bewitched?
No, I'm not.
Because she was called Sabrina. All witches had to be called Sabrina by law.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. But
maybe there was.
I think there was. The reason I say that is that when I was watching this, I was reading some stuff online from the creators of the original cartoon strip, and there was a reference to the writer being amazed that it was made into a TV series. They were all surprised by how big and successful it came. And that was it. It was in 1969. Yeah. So it might have been.
The 90s one. I've got to say, I loved the 90s one. Yeah. It was the highlight of my week. It was a massively corny sitcom. It was a sit coven with Sabrina trying to act like a regular mortal girl with her two kind of ditzy aunts who are witches. And the best thing about it was this fantastic talking cat called Salem.
Salem the cat.
Who was like this character from literally the Catskills. He was like a corny old... He was like Jackie Mason in the form of a cat with a kind of ironic side-eye to everything and just obsessed with food and always like ruining Sabrina's plans. And one of my favourite bits, he used to go on chat rooms on the early internet holding a pencil in his mouth and try and chat up women. He's this talking cat. He was just fantastic.
Lord.
This one is much more serious and, quote, dark, isn't it? And it's got a narrative and everything. Sean, set it up for us. What's happening here?
Sabrina is a 15-year-old half-human, half-witch. She is days away from her 16th birthday, and she has to decide whether she wants to stay a mortal or join the witch world. She goes to a normal school. She looks very normal. She is played by Kiernan Shipka, who was in Mad Men. So she is fresh-faced, very American, very blonde. But there is trouble ahead because she has some big decisions to make, and obviously the forces of evil are just next door. I mean, they're basically in the next leaf. They're swirling around her, and so we're set up as the is she or isn't she sort of question, aren't we?
Did you like it?
I didn't dislike it. I thought it was for people who were very much younger than me.
Yes.
What I felt, I'm never quite sure with Netflix. I don't think they've quite got the marketing, because you suddenly see Sabrina everywhere and there are adverts everywhere at the moment. I haven't not seen it anywhere and on covers of things. And so I'm thinking, well, this is Stranger Things, which I would quite enjoy and I can watch that with the kid. Or is this something that is meant for teenage girls, because there's an enormous picture of a teenage girl there? I think it's for, as I say, teenagers and young adults. And in that sense, there were lots of tropes and themes and things that I was familiar with, I quite enjoyed, but I wasn't sure that exactly it's aiming at me.
Richard Benson, you've got kids. What did you think of it?
I've got a 12-year-old daughter who's obsessed by Riverdale.
Oh, right.
And she knows about this but hasn't watched it yet, but I know that she will love it because that sort of gothic, histrionic sort of darkness in it.
It's attractive teenagers in a kind of vaguely frightening world, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I thought it was really different to the Melissa Joan Hart one, in that a bit like Buffy, which this is also a bit like, was very much about the tension between, you know, being a witch but being in a very sunny suburban kind of world. Hmm. But the world of the Chilling Adventure, this one, is like, you know, the world is dark and horrible already, isn't it? Everything, there isn't a kind of a sunny suburban side of then your life as a witch. Kind of everything looks pretty grim. I mean, just the visual of it is that everything's kind of rainy,
bleak,
and dark.
Yeah.
All the teachers in the school are horrible. You know, it's kind of like, you know, don't worry about being in hell, because you're kind of already there, really. So it's a bleaker kind of thing. But the works. I loved it. I have to say, I loved it. Yeah.
There's a lot of sort of. What did you enjoy about it? What were the things that you enjoyed?
I thought the first two episodes were clunky because it was just the sort of exposition stuff. But that's kind of, you know, in series that's so often the thing. I thought by the third one it was kind of settling down. I liked that they'd gone like full on bleak, dark, gothic horror. I thought it had like a really strong vision of something, and I thought that, you know, the way it looked was really good. And the main thing is her, because she. You know, Kenan Shipka, because she, you know, that is a big ask, right, for like an 18-year-old to go, like, you're going to carry the whole thing. The whole thing rests on her. Mm. And she pulled it off, I thought, by the third episode. I thought she looks absolutely brilliant, and she carries it. So the main thing is that for me.
Yeah. Andy Teasdale, I can't imagine this is your cup of tea. You hate goths. What did you think?
I hate anyone. I'm a nice person.
You do hate goths.
Horrible person.
What did you make of this?
I found it confusing. I mean, obviously, it's not the sort of thing I would normally watch, which is good. But I did watch it. I mean, in the end, me and my wife watched four episodes. So after four episodes, I think I agree with Richard, I did start enjoying it. There's a few things that confused me about it. First, I wasn't sure when it was set.
Yeah, it's in this sort of like neither the present day nor 1956 kind
of. Do you know what I mean?
But
yeah.
I think that's the conceit of Riverdale and the Archie comics, isn't it? It's both now and then.
It's like, is this the 60s or not? I did think it crowbarred in American identity politics into it.
Oh,
it had
a
thing.
Now,
you might like that, but it was like they had an intersectionality group. At the school, they had a thing where the lads were awful, and I just thought, I don't know. I wasn't that keen on that because I thought it would create more division, and for me that felt quite uncomfortable, and it was crowbarred in. However, once it got going, it did grab me, and I thought she was ace. And I stopped thinking about that other stuff which had confused me at first, and by episode three I thought, well, this is actually good and it's quite addictive. And it started to be like a proper good horror telly series. And it had the devil in a very Rosemary's Baby sort of way, looking like a goat.
Yeah.
Which, and I don't mind a goat.
Okay.
In a horror thing. And actually, by the end, I thought it was really good and very entertaining.
Sean, you liked the identity politics bit.
Yes, I did. I liked the way that they were drawing clear parallels between covens and women's groups. That was really good.
They're the same thing.
Hey.
Breitbart.
Well, yeah. Or maybe not. One of the characters is talking about trying to set up the young people in praise of the Black Panthers group, which didn't work out or something like that. Yeah. There's some really nice references to it. But they're also the... say the themes. I mean, some, I wanted it to look slightly more like A Company of Wolves, which, if you're very, very old, you remember what that looks like. Even more dreamlike, even weirder. There's a wonderful thing where Sabrina wears this red coat, this little Red Riding Hood, that all these different, say, sort of glances and references to other things. I think, as I say, she's brilliantly cast. I think the casting direction in this is wonderful. I really enjoyed looking at people acting. You know, you sometimes think, God, that's really difficult, something we might get to later. But they're really enjoying the roles. You can see it's going to flourish. She is amazing. So, yeah, I think it's a, I think it's getting there. I think it's good. But I do worry that, you know, I have, as a person of my age, I've sort of seen it all before.
Well, yeah.
Are they meant to get me in or do they not care? They probably don't care.
I don't know. Well, we are the old people and we are now irrelevant, aren't we? But I mean, I really liked, I loved Michelle Gomez as Madame Satan because I'm a huge fan of hers. And I actually passed her in JFK Airport in the summer. I was walking along there she was with her headphones on and my jaw dropped and she gave me a double thumbs up and just walked past Michelle Gomez. I love it. I thought she was a really good thing in this because her hyper over-intensified, hyper real
it really works,
fits in here.
Lucy Davis is very good.
Lucy Davis
well,
and the Office is in it as well. And to me, she was the one who had the most in common with the Sabrina that I used to enjoy because she's the very scatterbrained Hilda with and really charming and really funny. But my problem with it, I mean, I actually found it a lot flatter than that. And I found the kind of concentration on you know, the on bringing in real horror elements made it more generic, not more individual. I really missed the charm and the comedy and the essential ridiculousness of it. To me, it's like, why are you trying to build... I mean, the producers have said that their kind of touchstones were Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist and 70s horror. And I thought, this is like trying to remake Dad's Army as Saving Private Ryan or something. You know, why are you trying to bring this realism or rather these kind of tropes into something that was at its most successful as a really charming light comedy? When you look at things like The Good Place, imagine old Sabrina being made with the production values of The Good Place. It could have been really, really great. And instead what you've got is something that's a little bit kind of, it's kind of a Harry Potter knockoff and it's a little bit Stranger Things. It just felt to me like one of the many, many generic. But then I am old. Yeah. I'm old.
Oh,
I'm not 14.
I like the horror thing. I think they should have pressed the horror button a little bit more. But I only seen one episode, so I don't know if it gets more horrific.
It does get quite Rosemary's Baby. It does get, I mean, it's good.
Did anybody think that there was a bit of like you know some populism references in it? I thought when the that kind of debate that they have in the first couple of episodes, where they're talking about power and freedom, and what you trade off to get power, and what power you might lose if you're being free. And I thought if we look back at this in 10 years' time and just think about what Trump was doing and what was going on, even with, you know, when you think of in this country, this was to do with Brexit and the you know. The whole idea of witch hunts, you know, is it seems really relevant now. And I thought, God, this will seem when we come to look at it later, this will seem very much of its time.
Do you think they're going for I Was a Teenage Handmaid's Tale here with a kind of modern politics ripped from the headlines?
I did think there was a bit of that in it, actually. I did wonder about it, and that's what I thought when they. Because I thought the way that they, I mean, they really went for Satan, didn't they? I mean, this is like funny witchcraft. This is like the devil's in it, you know, literally burning pits.
Yeah,
in,
people
in,
actually
in
the die. There's blood and horror and all kinds. Genuine pain and misery.
So I thought there was a bit of dystopian imagery in it that I thought keyed it into now.
It really does. I think it really reflects American politics of the moment. Mm. We are in more serious times, either for good or bad, but they. That is reflected in this show, and at times I thought it was a bit crowbarred in, but I would say that once you get past episode 3, you forget about that, and it's worth watching.
Maybe so. I mean, my problem is I think it's really easy to go dark with things. It's really easy to go, you know, we're going to make this. It's much, much harder to do a kind of to do charm and warmth and something that lifts you up a little bit. But what do I know?
I think it would have got more flack for being a comedy witch show, quite frankly.
Because it's totes inappropriate for today's modern witches who are oppressed. Okay. Well, that's enough witchcraft. Anthony Teasdale, it's your turn to make an editor's recommendation. What track have you brought in for us?
Okay, so it's called Slow Down by Arp Feynman.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a chunky little vocal track, a little breakbeat. It's slightly otherworldly. I'm going to have to say it's Balearic.
You brought the Balearic. Do you know anything about him?
No, I know nothing about him because I'm never that interested in the background of these people. All I know that it sort of has that. It has to me what I really do like about sort of pop music. There is an otherworldly exotic quality to it. Hmm. It's a record that is at once familiar. I'm sure I've heard this before. And also a bit strange.
Where did you come across this record?
Because I have no life and don't get out much, I follow lots of different people on Spotify and various lists. And it was on one of those. There's a fella in Copenhagen called Kenneth Braga. And though he sounds like a darts player, Kenneth Braga is from Copenhagen, runs a label called Music for Dreams. I don't want the music to my dreams. And he's always recommending great stuff, and this was on there.
Well, this is Art Feynman, and it's Feyman if you want to be Spotifying it, and it's called Slow Down.
Slow down, regret yourself, don't look at a diamond, yeah. Slow down, regret yourself, don't look at a diamond, yeah. Liberty is the same song.
Right, more telly, specifically Channel 4's new spy drama Berlin Station, currently on its third season in the US, but suspiciously only just debuting in the UK. It features a CIA agent called Daniel Miller, who signs Depeche Mode and Nick Cave to Mutrak. No, he is posted to Berlin, where he experienced a childhood traumatic upbringing. He's been reposted to Berlin to nail the Julian Assange-type figure who's leaking the agency's documents all over the internet. There, he encounters his old mate and fellow agent Hector, who seems to have gone native, and a world of moral compromise, deception, real politic, and amazing shots at the Brandenburg Gate opens up before us. Before we talk about it, here's the theme tune. It's David Bowie with I'm Afraid of Americans. Did you see what they did there?
I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world.
So then, Berlin Station there, Channel 4's new US import spy drama. We're in the seedy world of espionage. Everybody's drinking coffee morosely while staring out across the street. And Reese Ifans is in it playing a dissolute spy in the seedy German underworld. Richard, the basis is this kind of fictional Julian Assange, Edward Snowden scenario where a figure called Thomas Shaw is leaking CIA materials. The CIA is on the back foot and a spy called Daniel Murray is sent to clear it up. What did you make of it?
I did not like it. Mm. I just felt really underwhelmed by it. I thought that it almost had, for me, lots of things in it that are just somewhat what can go wrong with television programmes, to be honest. I thought that the trouble with doing a plot about someone like Julian Assange, like now, is, you know, the truth, the reality of it is always going to be more bonkers and more interesting than you can actually get away with in a fictional setting. So you get these kind of dramas where they're trying to take something from real life and turn it into drama. And actually, it ends up feeling just like a slightly rubbish version of something that really happened. So that for me, I didn't find that very gripping. I thought the acting... It's difficult playing spies because spies are all about concealment and being downbeat and not giving... Mm. So then acting that is very, very difficult, I think, unless obviously it's James Bond. And for me, all of them just seemed a bit, like, boring. And... I thought the music was terrible. That is far too obtrusive. I thought the lighting was really weird.
The haircuts were shocking.
And I thought it was really clunkingly in tribute to Berlin. So I thought it was almost like playing like Berlin Bingo, right? Because it was like, oh, here's the 70s like East German housing block. Here's the 70s furniture. Here's a dodgy club with like transvestites.
Here's the panorama bar.
Here's the U-Bahn. Here's the S-Bahn. Here's the Brandenburg. And I thought, oh, but yeah, I actually said at one point, I was watching this with my wife, and I said, you know, they're going to have that, you know, the Tegel Airport in a minute. And literally 5 minutes later, it came out.
It's like all spy things set in London. All spies have a flat with a view of Big Ben, don't they? Mm. How is that? Yes. It's interesting because you would have thought they'd live further away to be less traceable. Apparently not. Yes, same thing in Berlin.
Yeah. They all. It'd be very easy to catch a spy in Berlin, wouldn't it? You know,
where just looking for the sight lines. He's standing by the window having a phone call again.
Yeah, well, I did think that there's a bit where Rhys Evans comes out of the club, I think, is it, and he's walking down the street, and somebody runs up to walk next to him, and they're walking very fast and having a kind of. And I thought, you look really conspicuous. Yeah. He looks walking fast down.
You look like a pair of spies. Anthony Teasdale. I mean, what with all the kind of the USB, despite the USB sticks and the kind of data sweeps, it did seem really old-fashioned. I thought. What did you think of it?
Well, I mean, I was hoping it was going to be set in 1974 with everyone looking like Fred Truman.
Yeah.
But they didn't. It was sort of like, I don't know, a bargain bin version of the Bourne Identity. And it had, so like there's this bad guy, this Tom Shaw in it, who looks like he's in the suite, doesn't he? Because he's got like this, and he's like a bit weird and gothy. And I mean, I do love this sort of, I do like a spy caper, especially one set in, you know, Eastern Europe. But again, it was all right. And I gave it a go, and by the end, I was sort of vaguely interested to maybe watch the next one. But the first half, I was totally confusing. I had no idea what anyone was doing. There was a subterranean sort of like CIA station. And they all say things like this, we've got to call Langley. Do you know what I mean?
Everybody, there was no sort of, the dialogue was not just expositional, but immensely cliched.
I've got some quotes here.
you look like you need a coffee. That happened. You look like you need a beer twice in 10 minutes. Yeah, Sean, you clearly
I wrote some down. I missed some at the beginning. I was going to write them down, but I sort of lost the will to live in the middle and then tried to get it back again. There's a bit where they go, the Nazis with their jackboots, they fucking owned it. I was just like, oh God. I mean, come on, that's meant to be like a big boss being so ballsy. Yeah. Another one was, Shaw isn't just a whistleblower, he's a murderer. And I thought, how did that get through? Mm. That line should not have got through. Unbelievably, all those spies in record shops talking really loudly and being recorded. Why would you meet someone in a record shop where there's loads of people?
People who like records really cool. Don't even go to record shops anymore. Never
loads
mind
of vinyl,
spies.
And there they are again, talking really loudly. Someone said, you know, things like that were a bit like, can you just, you know, do what spies do?
Something else like I really stuck out to me is like, when people are doing secret conspiratorial things, why do they go really high up on landmarks to do it? You know, wouldn't you? You'd meet someone really, really quiet, wouldn't you? You would go, I'm going to go up on the Fernsehen Tower, and you know, just, or I'm going to go in London. I'm going to go to the Greenwich Observatory. Yeah. You know, it was so TV-ish in that respect.
Very TV-ish, and they were very, very pleased with lots of people talking about the plot for the first half hour, and I couldn't understand it. I thought they're pleased. I can't understand it because then they think that's really clever. But actually, I'm getting bored of it because I don't really want to know who's on whose side and who's going to double cross. I just want a bit of action, please.
I sort of think making a spy show like this in the era when everyone has seen not just Tinker Tailor but also the adaptation of Tinker Tailor and all the other Le Carres, which are, and this is a theme we return to on the show often, all dramas are essentially workplace dramas in one way or another, and workplaces run on shared humour and rivalries. They run on who gets on and who doesn't get on. They run on who's late to the office today. They run on the mundane and the quotidian, which Le Carré is brilliant at. You know, his smiley stories are all, they're basically tales of boring admin people sucked into something bigger. And this is like, this is like a person who's never done spying's idea of spying, I'm sure of it, even though I've never done spying. It just struck me as kind of so behind the pace.
Yeah.
And, you know, you said a contemporary version of Bourne.
Yeah, Bargain Bin.
Bargain Bin Bourne. But Bourne itself, it was so much more sophisticated because it had an understanding of power dynamic inside cover institutions. This just seems to be like born cosplay to me.
I mean, did none of them watch Celebrity Hunted, which I'm still obsessed by? That's how you get your spy tips. That's how you get your subterfuge. That's real. This isn't. Watch Celebrity Hunted.
Yeah.
I think the thing about those Le Carré, you know, Le Carré's books are, you know, they're about spying, but they're about deception and loyalty and how people make relationships like that, and then they happen to be set in a spying world. Whereas I think you get stuff like this where they're just kind of copying all the kind of the way that it looks and the way it seems, and unless you've got that depth in it, because spies fundamentally don't do anything very interesting apart from, you know, the end of it when there'll be a shootout. You've got to have some proper engagement with like characters and this just didn't have that. I thought the terrible dialogue was my favourite line, was where somebody was talking about his kids and he said, I don't want my kids growing up in anywhere, anything goes Berlin. I thought, just in case you haven't got it, there's a lot of clubs here.
You cannot imagine a human being saying that, can you? It's absolutely impossible.
Now, this is where Killing Eve kind of knocks it at the back of the net, because this is about a similar subject matter, is some sort of subterfuge. But actually, it's about having a coffee, having a hangover, not getting on with your husband, weird lesbian stuff. That has all the minutiae that this lacks, I thought. Yeah. That's where it succeeds, and this, it just failed.
Yeah, absolutely. So the advice is forget this and keep calm and Le Carré on.
Finally, a bit more music. It's time for Andrew's turn. What have we got, Andrew Harrison?
Well, Judah, the Italian Slade, have got a new record out, surprise.
You love them.
I love Judah.
Yes.
They look like.
I've never heard them.
Oh, they're so up your street. They are bother glam. Yeah. They've got massive sardis. They've got big boots. They sound like 1974. They're from Rome. They support Roma. And everything they do has got a glitter beat, or it sounds like status quo. They are such fun. They are a breath of very old fresh air. I went to the Lexington early this year. I think I mentioned it on the show. It was just the most exciting, life-affirming thing. And they've put out a limited single on, I think, Damaged Goods Singles Club. So this, be patient, listeners. This is a dodgy vinyl rip. They've done a cover of Elton John's Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting in the bother style. And here we go. This is Judah with Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting. You can get it on Spotify if you want to listen to it. You have to spend £20 on a 7-inch single. The end of the show is coming, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be talking about over a warm Watney's Red Barrel while Judah nick a policeman's helmet and spray Judah Rule OK on the bus shelter? Richard Benson, what have you got?
Well, Andrew, I have got the return of Roy of the Rovers, the famous fictional footballer who the rights to whom were bought by...
Rebellion.
Jesus.
2000 AD Rebellion.
Yes. Rebellion. The owners of 2000 AD. So they bought all those the classic British comics, and they have been for the last few months, year, been sort of preparing a new version of Roy the Rovers. This is not the old Roy who they kind of kept going as long as they could through the 70s and 80s and 90s. This is a new kid where we see him starting from scratch at 16.
The only kid in Britain called Roy.
It's
a real old man's name, isn't it?
They're Melchester Rovers. I think I'm right in saying a languishing League Two at the moment, and he's playing for a non-league team, and he's just about to get. He goes and gets trials with Melchester and gets signed up to them. There's a straight novel, and there's a graphic novel. That the straight novel's already out. The graphic novel is coming this week, next week, I think. But I wrote about this for Esquire, and I went to speak to a guy called Barry Tomlinson, who sort of curated Roy as the editor in the sort of famous sort of 70s and 80s period.
Was he in Shoot?
No, Roy was originally in Tiger, wasn't he?
There we go, the voice of the terraces there.
He was in Tiger,
yes.
And then he was on it. Is it? I mean, I was a huge Roy fan. I remember their city rivals were Melbro.
And
there was I remember the teammates. There was like Vic Guthrie, who was like the super brat character, wasn't it? And his wife was called Roy's wife was called Penny.
Penny Race.
Right.
So she was. And the interesting thing about Penny. So what Barry did was he saw, you know, in the 70s he could see the comics were losing out to telly. So he went all out to get publicity for Roy through the newspapers. So he claims that Roy was the first comic book character ever to be married.
Huh?
So they did a bit. So the Roy Penny storyline, and then having children, and then she left him, and he did all that, Barry, to get the storyline in the paper. So if you go back to the early 80s, he just got loads and loads of coverage like that, and he's kind of like this light entertainer guy. So
was he the guy that got Spandau Ballet to sign for Melchester Rovers?
So he did all that. So when you look back at what he did, it's kind of amazing. So yeah, he got Spandau Ballet involved. He used to go around with cardboard cutouts of Roy, putting up with Bobby Robson, Malcolm McDonald, all the people, and the storylines got more and more bonkers, culminating in the team being killed in a terrorist attack in the Middle East, which when I went to see Barry in Lincolnshire, he said, I think I maybe went a bit far with that one. But
didn't original Roy get his leg blown off or something and he couldn't play again?
In the end, he did.
Didn't
he also get shot, Richard?
He did get shot. Yeah. That was just the J.R. Dallas thing.
He did. Now, the new Roy is being written by the great Rob Williams, who's writing The Best Judge Dredd at the moment.
This is
exciting to me. And Rob is fantastic at really clever story architecture, I believe they call it, you know, where you build things over a long period of time to produce amazing surprises. And it's out as a graphic novel.
Yes, it is. And the thing that's interesting in the when you think about what the writing of it's going to be, I think the graphic novel's going to be the sort of flagship bit of all this, is that they're, you know, I spoke to the people at Rebellion, and they're very much saying, you know, Premiership football is just ripe for this sort of drama now, and they want to make it, you know, very relevant and of the moment. And so I think it could be amazing.
Fantastic.
If you get it right.
I'm going to go into Gosh Comics and get somebody's recommending comics on the show that isn't me. Can you believe it? Anthony Teasdale, what's your closing time chatter?
Yeah, the clock's going back.
It's terrible, isn't it? It might be the last time it happens.
Well, I mean, you know, there's lots of jokes about going back to 1974, et cetera, et cetera. However, from what I can tell, and this, I mean, I do actually have a problem with this. This is why I could never live in Norway, despite the knitwear. And
you should call your autobiography Despite the Knitwear.
It's this thing, and some people just genuinely like it, some don't. I'm one of those. Obviously, the clocks go back, and suddenly you are, all right, you're going to work in the light, but I was going to work in the light anyway. I'm now coming home in the dark. Mm. And it, to me, it says, right, stay in, bullseyes on telly, it's beans and chips for tea, and the telly shuts at half 11, you should be in bed, not under one of them continental quilts, under itchy blankets. And I find it incredibly depressing that by 4:15 in December, it's going to, you know, it will be dark. And I just think, why are we doing this every year? And
well, Europe is going to stop it. They're going to start because it's, you know, they're having a European-wide edict to end the clocks changing.
Yes.
And apparently we're going to stick with it because we want to keep British summertime because of Brexit.
Yeah, so we're not having... So we will stay, go... So, I mean, I think we'll do the clocks... I mean, we have BST. This is so boring, I look at this quite a lot. We're British summertime 7 months a year, GMT 5 months a year. And the BST is there to give us more daylight hours, you know, when we would use it. What they're going to do in the EU is stick with the summertime time. No matter what time zone they're in, they're going to stick with that, which will mean darker mornings in winter, but it will never get that dark early.
And this is why you must have hard Brexit right now. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
The hip young gunslingers going middle England. I mean, surely everyone's noticed. What are they doing? We have this obsession with punk, that punk is true and it's pure. And if you come from that place, there are exhibitions about it, there are books about it, blah, 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 blah. But in actual fact, Julie Birchall and Tony Parsons are two of the most right-wing people in this country. And we must stop this legacy of punk being this thing and acknowledge it as just something that happened. And it can't always be pure. It can't always be the left-wing DIY ethos that we had. They continue to use, people are just open mouthed at me around this table here. They continue to use this idea of, you know, the enemy, you know, we were the voice of punk, to be now the voice of the people. They have this idea that they're not the elite and there is still this elite that are dictating to us what we should do. I just think
sick of hip young gunslingers.
Well, I am sick of I have decided. Mm. Yeah, that this legacy can't continue. We must disown punk as a political act and say, no, it doesn't stand for what it used to, and can we get over it and look to the future?
There's probably a huge discussion in that. We might do that on another episode. Mm. Yeah.
That Julie Birchall Brexit play, I can't even think about it without getting really, really annoyed.
It's really right that there's... The really annoying thing with that position of I come from an underground alternative, whatever it is, youth culture, and now I'm going to go, actually, UKIP is the alternative, as if you're the man of the people. You can only have that position if you live in a metropolitan bubble, because you know, if you think UKIP is some kind of shove it up an alternative that's kind of like against, you know, those sort of values, if you're in Barnsley, it doesn't feel like that. It just feels like it's the thing that everybody does. It's, there's nothing clever or like rebellious about it at all. It's just it's the like it's a fairly default position. And so I think for, you know, I was great admirer of Tony Parsons' writing, but I just think for him to take that position now is so deceitful, because it's not the voice of it isn't really the voice of Essex. It's somebody from originally from Essex posturing as that to me.
But that's what we've been hearing that for like knocking on 40 years. The values of an elite establishment presenting itself
but
as an alternative.
He uses
radical
these terms. He uses snowflake and things like that. You think that's just? I mean, I know he's not that good a writer anymore, but it's so lazy.
Yeah.
And Birchall does it as well. I come from a working class family, therefore I am pro Leap. I mean, no, that doesn't make sense. Your sum does not add up to me.
Well, my closing time chat is a really quick one. I'm doing a talk tonight with our old colleague Dylan Jones, editor of GQ magazine, talking about David Bowie, the secrets of David Bowie. And I discovered in his book, David Bowie, A Life, that, you know, this the story of David Bowie's hereditary madness, the madness in the family, the schizophrenia that made his brother, half-brother Terry, kill himself. Apparently, the tale was always told there were mad aunties here, there were mad aunties there, people were always getting committed. My life was defined by fear of madness, that I would wander off the path of sanity and go nuts. His cousin, Christina Amadeus, the amazingly named Christina Amadeus, debunks this completely. She says, no, there's no history of madness in the family at all. There were some breakdowns caused by things you could imagine happening to a family that lived through war when people had suffered terrible injuries, or they'd come back from fighting, or someone had died. That might cause a nervous breakdown. But the idea that there was some kind of madness gene in the Bowie family wasn't really true. So this leads you to think that, well, Bowie is kind of mythologized himself. I know he wasn't the full quid in the 70s. He wasn't necessarily playing with a full and balanced deck of and a set of judgment, because he was living on milk, cocaine and red peppers. But he took this idea that his family had this kind of stain in the DNA and mythologized it. And the interesting thing is, perhaps it wasn't true. Bowie, a bit more of a showman than we thought. So there you go. And that's our show. Thank you to Anthony Teasdale and Richard Benson for coming in. You're welcome back anytime you like, chaps. They're going to stick around for the extra bit, when we're going to talk about terrible titles for great albums, and you can get it if you back us on Patreon. Just search Patreon Romaniacs to find out more. Thanks for listening, Sean. Thank you as ever.
Thank you.
We're going to do the extra bit in a minute, but for everybody else, we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.